We understood that there was not going to be one deus ex machina thing that we could do to protect democracy. What we needed was we needed essentially to activate all of the tools that are embedded in the American democratic constitutional system, which were designed to guard against tyranny, to make sure they were doing their jobs. We had to animate our institutions.
This is Mission to Scale, a podcast that reveals the tools, mindsets, and strategies that organizations and funders need to maximize their impact. Because the world's biggest problems need solutions at scale. I'm your host, Dan Beredovitz, founder of Spring Impact. For a long time, the US called itself a beacon of democracy. But recently, the democratic foundation under which the country was built is feeling shaky, and there's talk of lost faith in the integrity of institutions. The attacks of January 6 on the Capitol felt like a wake-up call to many. But others, like Ian Basson, noticed the US democratic values deteriorating long before. Ian is the co-founder and executive director of Protect Democracy. He's also one of the 2023 Skoll awardees. In this episode of our special series with the Skoll Foundation, Ian tells us how Protect Democracy has been working behind the scenes to prevent the rise of authoritarianism in the US. Seeking to make a positive impact in people's lives and society, Ian has spent his career bouncing back and forth between the government and nonprofit sectors.
Government, that's where you have the greatest power and potential to make an impact on how we govern our society, how we allocate benefits to maximize the quality of life for the most people. And then when the politics and bureaucracy of government kill you, leave and go into the nonprofit world where you can dream bigger and you're untethered from the restrictions of government to try to create dreams and visions of what an ideal governing system and society should look like. And then when you feel in the nonprofit world like you're banging on the door and nobody's listening, go back into government again where people have to listen. And so when I left government the first time, I was really fortunate to be able to go to a series of nonprofits that have done a really terrific job, both first at trying to organize people across the world to stand up for human rights, for the protection of the environment, and for the protection of common goods that matter to all of us. I've also done some work towards alleviating poverty in some of the poorest corners of the world, particularly in East Africa, where, you know, families are living on less than a dollar, less than $2 a day. And I did that because I thought that was a portion of the global population that was in most need of help and where some interventions could have the greatest possible impact on alleviating suffering and helping improve people's quality of lives.
Before launching Protect Democracy, Ian served in the White House Counsel's Office for the Obama administration.
I had what today we might refer to as the democracy portfolio, although that's not what we called it at the time. At the time, we called it ethics and government reform. And the reason I think we called it that back then is because we thought that our task was essentially improving our form of government, government reform, reforming it, making it better. The reason I think we call it democracy today is because in hindsight, we now realize that the task was not improving our form of government, but saving it because of the world in which we find ourselves in now, in which democracy itself is under existential threat. But what the portfolio essentially was when I was there was two things. One, in an affirmative way, trying to advance policies related to improving our form of government, our democracy. But it also involved a second component, which was making sure that people inside the executive branch followed the rules. And so I briefed almost every incoming political appointee at the direction of the president on the rules that attached to them now that they were public servants holding the public trust. So I and others would speak to incoming political appointees to orient them towards their new jobs. And in doing that, in sort of telling people what the rules are that govern their behavior as executive branch employees, you learn very quickly that a lot of those rules are not legally binding. A lot of those rules are just customary. They're traditions. They're handed down from one administration to the next.
Ian left the White House in 2015 to work on international anti-poverty efforts. At that point, he felt confident that American politics were heading in the right direction. But when the 2016 election came around and Donald Trump was elected, his thinking changed.
While I was probably less surprised than many others, I was still pretty surprised and alarmed. And the reality of it sinking in led me and some of my other former colleagues from the White House Counsel's Office, from the Department of Justice, to begin thinking very intentionally and deeply about what sort of threat that posed to our very system of government. Within 3 days of his election, a former co-alum from the White House Counsel's Office named Justin Florence sent me an email saying, should we try to assemble the other alumni of the White House Counsel's Office to get together and think about how we might be able to make sure that the rules that we used to enforce when we were in the White House still get enforced. And the reason I think we and others were concerned about that was because Trump had said things during the campaign that made very clear that not only did he not believe in some of the ideas around liberal democracy, that the rules that I had taken part in trying to implement and enforce, he didn't believe in, but he was actually organizing a campaign and a movement almost in complete opposition to them. Whether it was threatening to engage in war crimes openly, whether it was proposing to bring in a private security force of his own to displace the government-provided Secret Service, whether it was threatening to use the power of government to go after media entities, for example, whose coverage he didn't appreciate during the campaign. He threatened to block the merger between CNN's parent company, Time Warner, and AT&T because he didn't like CNN's coverage of him. These were the kinds of saber rattlings that you see in countries that are not democratic or not don't have liberal democracies. And so Justin and I began to meet within 3 days of the election to sort of size up just what sort of dangers our nation might be heading towards.
Ian began discussing these unfolding events with former colleagues. They worried that the customary rules they followed in the White House were under threat, and they knew these rules were essential to a healthy democracy.
In one of those conversations, somebody said, you know, what we're really talking about here with someone threatening to use law enforcement as a sword to go after their opponents and a shield to protect their friends is similar to what you're seeing in more autocratic countries under leaders like Viktor Orban in Hungary or Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela or Vladimir Putin in Russia. And perhaps we should talk to some of the scholars that have been studying those other leaders to better understand what may lay ahead for the United States.
Ian got in touch with scholars who'd been studying democratic threats all around the world. Understanding the historic patterns made it possible to more accurately predict what might lay ahead.
I called them up and said, you don't know me, but I am working with a group of former White House and Department of Justice officials, and we're worried about the threats that the incoming president and his administration and movement might pose to the rules governing liberal democracy and wanted to get your advice. And all those people essentially said, oh my God, thank God you're calling. Me and my colleagues in the comparative politics space have been trying to sound the alarm for the last several years about not only what's happening to democracy around the world, but the threats facing democracy here in the United States. It's far worse than you think. And you're the first group of former White House Department of Justice employees to call, and you need to do way more than you're thinking. All of the warning signs that we all have learned to identify in our scholarship of studying the rise and fall of democracy around the world about when you should be concerned that your democracy is in danger are blinking red here in the United States. And Donald Trump is symptom, not cause.
Ian learned the authoritarian playbook, the seven strategies that typically precede the fall of a democracy.
They said, there is a pattern in all of these countries that plays out pretty similarly, regardless of whether the person leading it is deliberate and strategic and Machiavellian, the way that someone like a Vladimir Putin or a Viktor Orban might be, or whether the person leading it is somewhat bumbling and accidental, the way someone like a Nicolas Maduro or Donald Trump might be. You end up in the same place because fundamentally, all of these leaders believe that they are the only legitimate source of power and that any check on their power is therefore illegitimate. And so either by instinct or design, eventually they try to undermine all of those checks. And what these scholars basically painted for us was a playbook that involved seven steps. First, these autocratic leaders politicize independent institutions like the civil service or the law enforcement or the military. Second, these leaders spread disinformation from the government. Third, they aggrandize power in the hands of the executive, and they try to undermine those institutions that are designed to be checks on an executive, like legislatures or courts or a free press. Fourth, they quash dissent. Fifth, they delegitimize vulnerable populations and scapegoat them. And this has, of course, been the tyrant's favorite tool since antiquity, right? Because if you can pit people against each other on the basis of race or religion or sexual orientation, you can pick their pockets of money and power while they're distracted. Sixth, these modern autocrats corrupt elections, but they hold them, which is interesting. The idea of democracy is so deeply baked into public consciousness that they can't do what the dictatorial or totalitarian regimes of the 20th century would do, which is just abolish democracy outright, as the Germans did in 1930. They don't do that. They maintain this sort of Potemkin democracy. And so they hold elections, but they corrupt the elections and they tilt the playing field. And then lastly, seventh, they stoke and incite violence.
Democratic values are deteriorating all around the world. Ian worried that the United States could be headed in a similar direction.
Pew did a survey a couple of years ago in which they looked at commitment to democracy around the world and found that openness to non-democratic alternative forms of government permeates every region and every country in the world at this moment in time. And I think that is because when you go through a period of transformation and disruption as we are living through as the result of new technologies, changing labor markets, globalization, changing labor markets, climate change, driving migration, and changing the demographic makeup of nation states, that creates a level of anxiety about the future. It creates challenges to what political scientists call status loss among previously dominant constituencies within countries that causes people to look at extreme alternative forms of government. And democracy is not intuitive. Democracy is a rare thing in human history. There's only a small fraction of countries over the arc of human history that have ever been governed democratically. We don't govern our businesses democratically. We don't govern our families democratically. It's not the easiest way to run a system. It's in fact ugly and difficult and slow and hard and frustrating. It takes a real commitment to do it. And so in moments when things aren't going swimmingly, it's not surprising that people turn away from the thing that seems like it's really hard towards things that seem easier. And one thing that certainly seems easier in certain moments of anxiety and fear and crisis is someone who comes along and says, "Don't worry, I alone can fix it."
Having the authoritarian playbook laid out, Ian and his team attempted to get ahead of it.
The first thing that we assessed and understood was that there's no one tool for confronting that authoritarian playbook. There is no silver bullet for preventing authoritarianism and protecting democracy. I mean, the US Constitution was designed as a way to guard against tyranny, and it weaves together a whole panoply of potential defenses and checks and balances. And so we understood that there was not going to be one do ex machina thing that we could do. Essentially, if our institutions that are rooted in the Constitution are the checks against tyranny, what we essentially needed to do was treat them almost like puppets and put our hand inside them to activate the mouth of the puppet and make the puppet do what it is supposed to do. Make it talk, make it speak, make it become alive.
Ian and his team launched Protect Democracy, hoping to build more resilient democratic institutions. The nonpartisan organization works through five primary tools.
We have a legal tool. I think we have one of the best in class legal operations in the nonprofit space. And it goes out there to make sure that through litigation, the courts do their job and the law is upheld. We have a legislative tool where we help build policies, build coalitions, and move them through legislatures so that the legislature can do its job in oversight and in writing laws and in checking the executive. We have a strategic communications operation that tries to help the fourth estate, the media, do its job through providing briefings to reporters and editors, and also through projecting publicly the narratives and information that the public need in order to do their job to self-govern. We have a software team and a software, essentially a company within the organization, that builds tools that help executives and government better be able to do their job. And then finally, we have a think tank team that is helping to really understand everything that's happening and essentially do research and development on other possible interventions that can help strengthen the threads of our democracy back into kind of the strong fabric that is necessary to make a democracy function. And so it's not one tool, it's all of the tools together that really create the kind of network that is necessary for democracy to function. Because ultimately, the ultimate guard, if there really is one guard at the end of the day against tyranny and in protection of democracy, it's the guard that the founders wrote into the first three words of the US Constitution, we the people. And so doing the task of being an active citizen is at root the most basic theory of change of everything that we're trying to do at Protect Democracy.
That's great. So it sounds like there's a lot that can be done, but you have been doing it already. So things from my seat look quite bad, but I guess they could be a lot worse. So what sort of things do you feel proud of that you've done in the last few years that have really changed the landscape that people may not have seen?
So I think if you had to rank the threats that US democracy has faced in recent years, from most dangerous to least, the most dangerous threat we faced was that an illiberal, autocratic-minded leader, once ensconced in the Oval Office, would refuse to leave and would use the levers of power at his disposal to entrench himself in that office against the will of the people and the constitutional order. And I will say there were a lot of people who thought we were crazy for warning from the inception of the organization that that was the number one threat. And unfortunately, obviously, we were proved correct in that being a serious threat. And so the question was, how could he do that? And there was one strategy that we identified very early on, which is, if you think back to the 2016 election, remember, he only won by a very small margin in a couple of states that tipped the Electoral College in his favor, about 88,000 votes distributed across a couple of states. So it was a remarkably close election. And as you recall, in the 11 days leading up to the election, there were two major news stories, both coming out of the Department of Justice, that re-injected the Hillary Clinton email scandal into the news, including 2 days before the election, when FBI Director Jim Comey made headlines by essentially both reopening the email investigation matter and then determining that he had closed the matter, but making that matter dominate headlines in the week leading up to the election.
Ian is referring to the announcement that Hillary Clinton used her private email while serving as Secretary of State instead of the official state government account. The FBI eventually concluded that there were no prosecutable offenses. At the time, the announcement tainted the candidate's reputation.
I think it is safe to speculate that given how close the election was, a news story in the closing hours of the election that Donald Trump's opponent was embroiled in some sort of scandal, whatever credit you want to give to the seriousness of the scandal or not, likely tipped a lot of votes in Trump's favor and very well may have been decisive. Trump saw that. Trump understood that very, very clearly. And for that reason, we anticipated that he would try to make sure that when he was up for election again, he could, now in charge of the Department of Justice, use it again to intervene on his behalf in the waning days of the election. And so from the very beginning, one of our concerns was that Trump would use the Department of Justice to ensure his own reelection by getting it to interfere inappropriately in his reelection campaign. So how could you stop that from happening?
Protect Democracy set out to issue a policy that would limit the Trump administration's interactions with the Department of Justice. In 2019, they worked with the Senate office to propose the Security from Political Interference in Justice Act. The law makes the relationship between the White House and the DOJ more transparent, ensuring accountability for inappropriate contact.
It gave the media and the public a standard against which to hold the White House accountable. And then we went around behind the scenes briefing media on how serious the danger would be to American democracy if those rules eroded. And that caused a lot of people in the media to pay a lot closer attention to whether the White House was hewing to those lines or not. And of course, the Trump White House was not. And so throughout the first months of the Trump White House, we helped the media tell a bunch of stories about how the White House was violating its own rules by interfering in the Department of Justice. And the predicate for when even more egregious violations were to come to light, there was even more outrage in the media, which then helped tell citizens that they should be concerned about this.
Their second strategy was to reach out to the alumni of the Department of Justice. They thought their voice could be influential in getting people currently serving in the DOJ to resist improper interference from the White House.
The Department of Justice as an institution is one in which people who come through it feel a deep affinity to that institution and to the community of that institution and to the ethics and norms of that institution. And so we began to organize alumni of the Department of Justice to play essentially the role of the Greek chorus in an old Greek play, to be essentially the conscience, the public conscience of our institutions. And, you know, as a Greek chorus does in those old plays, every time the playwright is trying to tell the audience a core lesson or a core principle of the play, the chorus sings that principle. And so we tried to animate the alumni of the Department of Justice to do that. And so every time the Trump Justice Department interfered, for example, in the sentencing of Trump's close ally, Roger Stone, or every time it seemed as if the White House would pressure the Justice Department, for example, to lay off the investigations into Trump through the Mueller report, we helped organize thousands of Department of Justice alumni to speak out with one voice. And every time they did that, it created a cascade of news stories of 2,000 DOJ alumni say, if anyone else had done what Mueller said Trump done, they would have been prosecuted. Or 2,000 DOJ alumni call on Bill Barr to butt out of individual cases helping Trump's personal allies and friends. And those stories dominated the media. And more importantly, we learned from people inside the Department of Justice that those stories stiffened their spines to stand up against political pressure.
When there is accountability, abuses of power are less likely to occur. In 2020, when a mob of Trump supporters stormed the US Capitol after the elections, Protect Democracy knew it was important for there to be consequences. They worked with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, to support the creation of the January 6th Accountability Committee.
And then supported that committee by building a cross-ideological coalition to help it in numerous ways get its message out to the public, and in particular, help package some of the information that came out of that committee to those people who were most ambivalent and unsure about what happened, what actually happened on January 6th, and may not have been following the hearing so closely, making sure to package the most important information from those hearings for those people. And that's really the same audience that at the end of the day ended up splitting their tickets in the 2022 midterms.
Protect Democracy didn't just want to inform citizens. They also wanted to stop misinformation from spreading. They knew that people would be less likely to spread false information if they were afraid of legal consequences. The issue was, not everyone who was falsely accused had the resources to fight their case.
So we decided that it might be helpful to set up a pro bono plaintiff's bar to allow those people who were the victims of this sort of injurious defamation to be able to sue. And we set up that project. It's called Law for Truth. It has now brought a number of defamation claims on behalf of people like the two election workers in Georgia, Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman, who were vilified and accused of engaging in fraudulent behavior, even when that was debunked by investigations in the state of Georgia, really had their lives turned upside down against some of the people who our suits alleged defamed them. And in one case, we represent a former Trump-supporting postmaster general who was falsely accused of backdating ballots for Joe Biden against the people who made that accusation. And these cases so far are creating a real accountability measure against those spreading disinformation. We think have also probably had a deterrent effect. And you can see that in the aftermath of the 2022 midterms, the amplification of conspiracy theories was much less in 2022 than it was in 2020. And I think one of the reasons for that is that people now see that defamation is a viable cause of action and are comporting their behavior in the way that traditional media have by making sure that they don't say things that are potentially injurious and libelous.
It is thanks to efforts like this one that Protect Democracy received a Skull Award for social innovation this year. Huge congratulations on winning the Skull Award. This is not an easy thing to do. A huge stamp of approval for what you're doing. What are you hoping comes out of this important moment?
Well, first thing I want to acknowledge that I am merely the person talking to you today on behalf of a team of almost 100 people who are just the best of the best when it comes to what they do and how they do it. The award, it is a huge boost in validation of what we are trying to do and our theory of the case, that this is a moment where we need to put traditional political allegiances and policy aside and create a coalition that's cross-ideological, progressives, moderates, and conservatives who are committed to protecting a liberal democratic form of government and continuing on the path of perfecting it. And I think that this award is a validation that that is a strategy that we all need to lean into at this moment in time. And we're incredibly grateful for it. What I'm hoping is that this award does a couple of things. One, wakes people up to just how existential the current moment is for a democratic form of government. Two, validates that this is not a moment in which we can decide not to engage in politics because it's sticky and it's hard and you get tagged with partisan associations. This is the moment in which we must lean into politics in order to save a form of politics that we all hope we can pass on to the next generation, which is one that really is fundamentally democratic in nature. This is not a question of Democrat versus Republican or Labor versus Tory. It's a question of small d Democrat versus more illiberal or authoritarian. And everyone needs to take a side in that one. That's not taking a partisan side. That's taking a side in what sort of form of government we believe in and whether self-government is something that shall endure. And I hope it suggests to all those people out there that we need to unite in coalition in service of this mission if we are to ultimately survive the challenges that are battering liberal democracy around the world and make sure that we make it through these choppy waters to hopefully calmer waters on the other side. The ultimate goal of our organization, Protect Democracy, is to close down. We would love to get to a point where every election is not an existential one for our form of government, and we can go and work on some of the other problems that are facing the world.
Ian believes that everyone has a role to play in preserving our democracy.
Democracy only survives when it has a citizenry willing to stand up for it. And that means everybody has a role to play, whether one is involved in entertainment work, in telling stories and impressing on our culture the importance of self-government and democracy, whether one is involved in religious work, whether one is involved in their churches, their temples, their mosques, making sure that those organizations are actively thinking about what it means to be small d Democrats within their communities. Whether one is struggling to overcome differences with one's neighbors, we are all living in much more polarized times. That means having more grace for people with whom we disagree. Democracy fundamentally is a form of government that expects us to resolve disagreements peacefully and live together with people with whom we have deeply different views about the good life. That muscle is atrophied for a lot of us. So what can one do in one's own community to build bridges across divides and become more tolerant and understanding of people with whom we disagree? Whether someone is involved in the business world, that's a segment of society that, if you read scholarship, plays an outsized role in either protecting democracy or being the handmaiden of its downfall. This is not a time for business leaders to step back, duck their heads, and avoid getting involved in what they fear might be political or partisan arguments. This is a time for them to lean forward and protect our very form of government from disappearing. There's a lot of pressure in media to be seen as neutral. Well, that's not right. You want to be unbiased, but not neutral when it comes to truth and democracy. Unbiased, but not neutral is where to be. So for every different segment in society, you have a role to play if our democracy is to survive. And I think what I would ask people is, have you answered that question for yourself about what your role to play is, and are you doing it? Because if you haven't asked that question, or you're not doing whatever the answer is, there's more for you to do.
In today's political climate, it's a relief to know that there are people like Ian working to safeguard democracy. Talking to him made me reflect on what I can do in this critical fight for democracy. I now have a clearer idea of what's possible, and I hope this episode inspired you too. If you want to learn more about Protect Democracy, you can visit protectdemocracy.org. And if you're interested in learning more about this year's winners of the Skoll Award for Social Innovation, visit the link in our show notes. Before we go, we'd like to thank the Skoll Foundation for the work that they do and for partnering with us in this series. If you love Mission to Scale, please recommend our show to a friend or colleague. You can subscribe or follow our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thanks so much for joining us, and I'll catch you all in the new episode next week. Mission to Scale is produced by Spring Impact and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about our work at Spring Impact, visit springimpact.org and follow us at Spring Impact on Twitter.